Good evening. Welcome everyone to Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Matt.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God,
bring me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. They're across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership.
We are self-supporting.
Oh, hi. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Sorry, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the steps discussed tonight. This evening, we are extending our discussion from last week on steps 8 and 9. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Shannon and Joe. All right. I'll now read the first paragraph on page 80, and then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand. But what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has already gone through hell for him.
I'd like to start.
You want
to go? Yeah, ladies first.
I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Shannon.
This was one of those things in the big book that I kind of had to adapt in my own mind to realize, like, because it was very easy for me to kind of try to compare myself out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and obviously it's very easy to do that when you're talking about husbands and wives, and I was 17 years old when I walked through the door, and I was like, I can't relate to any of that. Perfect. You know, when I look at it honestly, though, you know, I do see that my family was exactly like this. You know, my family was resentful and uncommunicative with me, you know, and me with them, too. And I felt lonely, you know, and I looked for fulfilling relationships outside of my family because in my mind, I had no idea why they couldn't stand me so much. And it's because of the way I acted when I was drinking, you know, and I strained those personal relationships with my own behavior, but... You know, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know how to change it. So even in getting sober, you know, those resentments lasted. You know, and that lack of communication lasted, and it was very difficult for them to believe that I was really behaving myself, because there were several times in my life I made it seem like that was what I was doing, you know, when really I was just out trying to get a drink. And, you know, it makes perfect sense that they would react the way that they did, but I didn't know what to do about it for, you know, a really long time. It wasn't until I had a sponsor go through all these steps with me and explain to me, like, here's how you're going to make things right, you know, steps 8 and 9, making amends, and what that really means, and which I'm sure we'll get more into later. But for now, you know, I guess my point is just, it makes sense that they were over my behavior, you know, they were over it at a certain point, because I was just belligerent, I was angry, I was such an angry drunk, and I'm not an angry person. Well, I don't like to think I'm an angry person anyway. And, you know, it's very easy for me to fall back into that, thinking the problem is with everybody else. And you know, I have to look at myself first. I have to look at, where did I set the ball rolling, you know? And yeah, it's kind of bringing me back to think about when my family really felt this way, you know, because, you know, I'm coming up on 4 years in September, and I have a wonderful relationship with my family. I have a sister who's about 2 years older than me, and when I was drinking, she felt like she was responsible for, you know, babysitting or trying to keep me out of trouble so that she could still do whatever she wanted, because the wrath of my parents tended to come down on both of us. But, you know, with my parents, they know I'm going to be honest, which is huge, you know, and I know that I can talk to them about most things, and you know, they know that I'll listen to them. You know, my sister knows that I'm not out to get something for myself. Every time we interact, we can actually have human interactions without any ulterior motive. And, you know, it's all because of this program. That's all I got for now.
Thank you. Thanks. My name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Joe.
I want to let you know up front, you know, I'm going to be a killjoy. You're not going to get a fifth step out of me with all the juicy details about this situation. I'm going to approach it from a different aspect. My wife at the time and my children have never seen me drunk, let alone pick up a drink. So infidelity for me wasn't the issue. I say my wife at the time because, you know, there was a divorce while I was sober. And I'll tell you a little bit about that and that situation. This situation here, it was actually reversed for me. Well, my wife was in the fellowship at one time, and while I was away on a deployment, she went back out and drank again, and there were some things that happened, and I'll leave it at that. Fast forward a few years and everything, my last tour of duty, I was in Afghanistan, and I came back from a deployment, and I was all set to retire from the Navy. And my wife at the time and I had been talking about this, and where we're going to go, and what we're going to do, and she was listening to me, and you know, when I got back home, and you know, I had all these great plans for retirement, and so did she. She had her own plans for my retirement, and they didn't include me. What? What page was that on? You know, and I had to approach this. I mean, my emotions ran from extreme anger to sadness, depression, and everything in between. And, you know, through that whole ordeal, I did not pick up a drink over it, and I'm grateful for that. You know, when I got home and I found out all the stuff that had been happening, and I went to my sponsor, and I was crying the blues to him, telling him about all this stuff. And he kind of, you know, he's listening to me, and he says, you know, it really sucks, but what are you going to do about it? And it was at that point where, you know, the rubber had to meet the road, and I had to get back to basics. I know we're talking about the eighth and the ninth step here, but I had to do a fourth step on that situation. And I had to make an amends for my part in the situation. The divorce wasn't entirely my fault. But one thing that my wife had said to me was that, you know, you're not emotionally there. I wasn't present. And there's a lot of times my head was at work. I was doing different things with the kids and everything. I wasn't emotionally there. Physically present, but not emotionally there. And, you know, I had to take my inventory, and I had to own up to stuff like that. And it takes two to make a marriage work. And again, I'm not going to get into the aspects and stuff that she had done. I just had to own up and take care of my side of the street, make sure my side of the street was clean, and make amends where they were due. So.
Thanks.
Thanks for sharing.
All right. Next reading is on page 82. If we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to his wife or parents, whom for years he was so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today. Would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came up out of this cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand, the wind stopped blowing."
I always love that part about the, ain't it grand, the wind stopped blowing, because that is so me. It's like as soon as the worst part of it is over, I'm like, we're good. Like, just sweep it under the rug, let's move on. And that's exactly that roaring my way through the life of others that they're talking about, you know? Because it's so much easier when I'm drinking for me to just, you know, look around, realize everything is terrible because of what I've done, and just go get drunk again. That's easy, you know? And it's hard to look at all the damage I've done and decide to stay sober and fix it. Like, that's a lot of work, and that's challenging, and you have to swallow your pride every step of the way. And, well, I did, anyway. And, you know, I really did think being sober would be enough at first. And I hoped it would. I hoped it would have been enough. Because I could do that, you know? I was like, all right, I can go to meetings. I can, like, hang out with UAA people instead of my friends that I want to hang out with. And, you know, I won't drink and everything will be fine. And, God, that was not the case. And, you know, early sobriety was not easy for me. I don't know if it's particularly easy for anyone. All I know is it was very, very difficult for me. And I'm thankful for that now, because had I not been in a situation where I had to recognize the way that I did tear through people's lives, no consideration for their feelings, no consideration for anything other than myself and what I need and what I need to do. And this is sober that I'm talking about, by the way. I did that drinking, but I'm also talking about early sobriety, you know? All I cared about was keeping my head down, telling myself not to drink, and getting to a meeting, going to school, and going to work, and just trying to figure out what to do in the meantime. And I was still, you know, my parents just wanted to talk to me now that my head was clear enough to even have a conversation, and I was, like, not capable of it because I was so pissed off and depressed and just evil 24/7 because I didn't know what I was doing, and I had all these resentments, and I didn't recognize that then because I hadn't been taught what those were. You know, so I didn't know why, but anytime anybody tried to talk to me about anything or wanted to spend time with me, I was 100% opposed. I wanted to be as far away from everyone as possible, and it was easy to do that in AA. It was easy to hide in meetings. It was easy to hide at my sponsor's house. And, you know, it wasn't until I started really getting into the steps, you know, and doing a fourth step and seeing where these resentments were causing me to continue to behave in the way that I was. And, you know, mostly the eighth step for me is what did it with that, you know, really, really recognizing the way that I just steamroll people in my life to get what I want, because there were, you know, I was instructed to use my fourth step as a basis for my eighth step, because in most scenarios, I owed an amends. But when I had to expand on my eighth step, when I had to expand that list, there were so many people that I had harmed who had done nothing to me. You know, no resentment attached, no nothing. They were just in my way when I wanted something. And I was distraught when I saw that, because I was like, oh my God, I'm a horrible human being who acts like this. And that's completely not the point of the eighth step. Like, you're not supposed to turn around. Well, I was told that I'm not supposed to turn around and be all morbid self-reflection and be like, oh my God, I'm worthless. It was more being able to see, you know, the fact that I am self-centered, the fact that I am selfish, the fact that I am inconsiderate when it comes to getting what I want, things I never saw before AA. You know, I thought everybody acted like I did. Everybody's selfish. You know, everybody wants what they want. Why wouldn't you? But I'm self-centered to the extreme. And, you know, that was only learned for me through really doing an eighth and ninth step and realizing the way that I had been living before getting sober. Thanks.
Thank you. You know, this portion of the reading here has always been a bitter pill for me to swallow. Because again, it had to force me to take a look at myself. I thought for the longest time that sobriety was enough. You know, I always thought that I was a great father and a great husband, and I was the breadwinner of the family. I had a good job, and you know, I was always striving to better myself at the job for the, you know, higher promotion, higher pay, set myself up in retirement and everything. The whole family would be more well off. And along the way, again, I was not emotionally there, as I said before, and I can see those things now looking back, hindsight being what it is. Like I said, it's a bitter pill to swallow. This alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others, and ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing. You know, I love those sayings as well. Talking about the eighth and the ninth step, I used to think that it was just about not drinking, that everything will fall into place. I'm a really good guy. I've stopped drinking, and I'm sorry for what I did, and sorry got to be a sorry word for me after a while. There was one particular point before I got married and everything where I had an employer, and I was basically a gas jockey. I was working at a gas station and had a 7-Eleven. I got sober a long time ago. My sobriety date is November 24th of 91. And where I'm from in Baltimore, the 7-Elevens and the gas stations just came on the scene back then. And I was working at a mobile station back in Baltimore, and I basically stole from my boss a lot, and stealing from the customers as well. And you know, when I got sober and it came time to make these amends and everything, I had my 8-step list, and I moved to York, Pennsylvania to get away from people, places, and things, my playground. And I was coming back to Baltimore on the weekends to see family and friends. This one situation, before I left, my sponsor at the time said to me, okay, you know, you've got this one guy on your 8-step list. If you see him, you know, go in and make amends to him. And regardless of what he tells you, accept it and move on with your life. So, yeah, okay, all right, thank you. Thanks, John. And I left, and I get back home, and lo and behold, I stopped at the station. You know, I wanted to see how they were surviving without me because I left, and I got fired, basically. And so I pull in there, and I walked in the back, and the owner's name was Charlie, and I said, Charlie, can I talk to you a minute? And he looked at me like he wore glasses, looked in the end of his nose like, what do you want? And I said, I just need to talk to you about some things. So we went in the back of the station, and I told him that, you know, I've gotten sober, I'm trying to clean up my life, and part of this process is me making an amends to you for all the things I'd done wrong. And I told him, I stole from you, and you know, I stole from your customers and everything, and I'm here to make things right. What can I do to make things right? And he looked at me and said, you made your bed, now you lie in it. Don't ever darken the doorstep of my business again. And I was like, well, you know, what am I hearing? I drove all this distance to make an amend to you, and you're treating me like this. And then all of a sudden, I didn't say that, I'm thinking that. All of a sudden, I remember what my sponsor said, that regardless of what he tells you, accept it and move on with life. You know, I thought it was just because, you know, I'm bettering myself. I cleaned my act up, and I'm trying to be a better person. I thought the whole world should accept me. You know, for all my shortcomings and everything, it was a minor misunderstanding, you see, and, you know, please accept my apology. That's not always the case. You know, I would say 95% of my amends have been positive, but that was the one instance where it didn't have a positive outcome, I should say. And I respected his wishes. I've never been back to that place since. And I've been to Baltimore numerous times to see family and everything. And it was what he wanted. I accepted it and I moved on with my life. And, you know, the sweet relationships are dead. They are. You know, in my mind, I thought they were great. You know, it's just a minor misunderstanding, my drinking and my embarrassing other people and everything. And I'm really not like that, you see. But, you know, put alcohol into my body and all bets are off. And I'm grateful that life isn't like that today. You know, I'm grateful that these things are behind us. And there's a part later on in the reading tonight where we talk about the promises. And a lot of those promises have come true because of me stopping drinking and changing my behavior. So.
Thanks. All right, I'm going to pick up on page 83. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fit the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone.
I was really into remorseful mumbling that I'm sorry. Because that was, again, that was the easy way out. I'm just wired, or was wired, probably still am wired to take the easy way out of any situation. You know, and my family, we really didn't talk about much growing up. It was more of a what happened, and we're good now, and we're gonna move on. And, you know, we did that all the time. I didn't have much practice in sincere apologies, you know, and I learned pretty quickly, you know, how to say sorry in a way that was so manipulative that you had to say it was okay. And that's terrible. You know, I didn't realize it at the time, of course, but looking back, I made so many manipulative apologies. And one of the most easy ones to make is like, oh, I'm just garbage. Or like, sorry, I'm just such a bad person. Sorry, I suck, you know? And, you know, that doesn't acknowledge my behavior at all. That's me telling you, like, well, I feel bad about myself already. So if you say that it's not okay, then you're saying I'm not okay. So you have to say it's okay. And it worked forever. You know how many times I got away with so many things just because somebody felt way too bad to say to my face, like, no, you're a something, you know? And, you know, just, it was so easy for me to just, like, not, like, and I didn't understand why people didn't know that I meant it when I said it. I meant that I was sorry every single time I said it. And I was sorry while I was doing things, you know? And, like, there would be times where I knew I had to go home. And, you know, somebody would be like, well, let's just have one or two. And I'd be like, okay. And as I open the first one, I'm like, God, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what's about to happen. You know, because it was never one or two for me. And, you know, I was around the kind of people who drank the way I did. Their consequences just were not anywhere near the consequences I had. And, you know, it's one thing to be sorry, and it's one thing to apologize, and it's another thing to make amends. And, you know, I had to learn the difference when I got to AA, because I thought it would be great to just sincerely apologize to people, because I mean it now, because I'm not drunk, and, you know, then we're good. Like, you either say it's cool or it's not cool. But, you know, then it got to the whole part about I have to change my behavior after I apologize for my behavior, which was novel to me. Like, that was groundbreaking, that the integral part of an apology is the changed behavior afterwards. And, you know, I hoped that every amends I made would be the kind where people told me to never talk to them again. Because that's easy. That's the easy way out. Like, if somebody just says, get out of my life, it's like, great, see ya. Like, then I'm not on the hook for nothing. And, you know, that wasn't the case. I don't want to say unfortunately, because I'm very fortunate, but I'm surrounded by somehow the nicest people on the planet, you know? You know, even in AA, I just so happened to gravitate towards the nicest people on the planet. Like, I wanted a sponsor who was going to be like, get in the car, we're going to a meeting. And like, call me every single day at this time. And like, no, my sponsor's the nicest. She was the nicest person on the planet. She's like, yeah, I mean, call me if you feel like it. And I'll help you. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so I'm in this situation where now I have to take responsibility for my sobriety. And all throughout the steps, I'm being taught how to take responsibility for my behavior, how to take responsibility for my defects, how to take responsibility for the pain I've caused, how to take responsibility for my alcoholism. And I don't like that much. And it was very difficult to think like I really had to change my behavior, because so many people around me that I made amends to said, you know what you can do to make it right? You can stay sober. You can keep doing what you're doing. And other than that, it was very simple, very easy, you know, just things being asked of me, like, keep in touch a little bit. Nobody ever knows what you're up to. We haven't talked to you since the last time you were here 2.5 years ago. And I do that, you know? I keep people away from myself. And it's easy to do that, but, you know, personal relationships are a huge part of this program. And I would have none if I hadn't made amends to people, because I was the one, you know, just twisting this relationship. In most cases, you know, because I didn't have the kind of relationships where I could easily say, like, well, they've done more to me than I've done to them. Because in most cases, it just genuinely was not true. So yeah, it wasn't easy. And, you know, asking each morning for patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. I should probably ask for all four, but when I'm in the morning and I rattle off the top of my head, I always ask for love and tolerance. Because the spiritual life is not a theory. I have to live it, you know? So it's a very large task for me to wake up in the morning and ask God to help me be loving and tolerant, and then to walk out onto planet Earth and still be loving and tolerant within 5 minutes of asking that. And, you know, it absolutely has to be something that I live and not just talk about, because I'm so quick to get resentments. I'm so quick to just think everything is pointless. I might as well drink. And if I don't have a power greater than myself, I'm going to drink. Like, that's just what I've learned in AA from, you know, my little periods of not trying anymore, because what's the point? Yeah, I'm gonna drink if I do that. So I have to live this life, you know? Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
We're talking about mumbling the word sorry. You know, I used to mumble sorry under my breath all the time. Sorry, I won't do it again. And like I said before, sorry got to be a sorry word after a while. People would judge me by my actions, you know, and I thought they should at least judge me by my intentions. I had great intentions, but when I put alcohol into the system, you know, actions spoke louder than words. And she was talking about this old drill sergeant curmudgeon of a sponsor. You know, I had one of those early on when I first moved to this area. Looking around, I see a few familiar faces from years ago, and you'll remember him. Bill Williams used to be my sponsor, and he was that drill sergeant, real hardcore, big book thumper from Craddock over in Portsmouth. And I was about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years sober, dry, and I went to him crying with a problem. You know, I forget what the crisis of the day was, but I was whining and crying to him, and he listened to me a little bit, and he said, I said to him, Bill, my program's not working. He said, good, try ours. And he meant that in all sincerity. You know, I wasn't doing what you people suggest, what the books suggest. It was self-will run riot. You know, all these years sober, and I'm still trying to ram my will down whatever the problem is. And, you know, today I am, it's still a learning process for me. I need the meetings because it's a constant reminder that I'm human, I make mistakes, and that I'm not the only one that makes mistakes. And, you know, and there are other people just like me. You know, we share our experience, strength, and hope, and we relate to one another. I was talking to Seth earlier in the meeting. It's like the one reason I love AA so much is because, you know, when I was drinking and my family was, you know, they're at me like this, you know, you need to stop, whatever. And we don't do that in here. You know, we're kind and loving and tolerant of each other, and we can relate to what it is we go through. And the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. You know, I've been sober a while, you know, more than half my life. And it doesn't mean that, you know, I have taken the advanced AA course. You know, it's all basic stuff. And it's all stuff like rinse, wash, repeat. You know, like you're doing your laundry or whatever. I've got to get back to the basics. I've got to do the things that got me here and kept me sober. And I just have today. You know, yesterday was a canceled check. Tomorrow's a promissory note. What do I do with today? And one thing that helps a lot with that is my sponsor tells me to stay where your feet are. In other words, to do what's in front of you. Stay in the here and now. And that helps me with being emotionally present, like I talked about before. I'm not as quick to anger as I used to be. However, you know, if I'm driving down the highway or whatever and somebody cuts me off, you know, I can go from 0 to 60 in the snap of a finger. And I have to stop myself, and I have to say to myself, speak out loud, you know, God, please bless them and heal me, you know. And it's come with some practice. That didn't happen overnight. And I have a friend that tried to, he was at a meeting one day, and he said that, you know, let's go to the advanced stages of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and as you're going down the road, try staying in the right lane, you know, and see how long that lasts. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? And he said, you know, think about it. You know, you're always in such a hurry to get where you're going. Try staying in the right lane a little bit. And I've tried that. And, you know, I don't like it a bit, one bit. But it forces me to slow down. It forces me not to take things for granted that I would normally take for granted. This spiritual life, you know, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to think that, I got here at a young age, and I thought that this was a religious program. And it's not a religious program at all, it's a spiritual program. And the difference is that religion is for people that don't want to go to hell. And a spiritual program is for people that, like us, that don't want to go back. And that's how I liken the difference. The God of my understanding is not the same God I had before I found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a God that's personal to me today, and I could know this book inside and out, but unless I live this program, unless I apply these principles in my life, it's still largely theoretical, like it talks about. And I have to do these things. You know, my existence depends upon it. You know, just because I've been sober, I've gotten remarried, I've been remarried 2 years now, and I've got 4 stepkids with that marriage. And there are some things that these teenage kids do to, I think, personally piss me off. Mm-hmm. That's not the case at all. They're doing what they do, you know? And I'll see dirty dishes in the sink. And rather than, you know, make a big scene about it or call them down here to put the dishes away or whatever, I'll just do it. You know, that's part of the advanced AA I was talking about. And I don't have to go through the rest of the day with resentment in my head. I don't have to go through the day, you know, thinking that they did that just to get me, you know, on my bad side. And that's not it at all. They're doing what they do. People do what they do. And I just happen to come along in life and, you know, something happens that knocks me off my beam. My job, what I've learned in AA, my job is to do a little bit of inventory about what it is, see what's out of bounds with God and society, and then pray for God to remove that excess, whatever it is, greed, pride, whatever. And when I do those things, I usually have a pretty good day. But, you know, I don't always do them, if you know what I mean. You know, because sometimes I like sitting in my stuff for a little while. But the easier, softer way is to do what you people suggest. You know, my days are relatively serene now. My second wife is, she's very spiritual. She's not one of us. She's normal in every aspect of the word. She'll drink occasionally. She had a wine cooler the other night, and you know, I'm just watching her drink it. I'm watching the condensation come down because she's not drinking it fast enough. She went to the Pungo Wine Festival a couple months ago, and she bought a bottle of wine from there. She brought it home and she drank it. She didn't like it. She didn't like the taste of it. She pours it down the drain, and I'm like, no! And she looked at me like, what's wrong with you? And I was like, that's alcohol abuse. And you know, it's. She laughed at it. I laughed. I caught myself. I laughed at it as well. And it's little things like that. if I didn't have this fellowship, if I didn't have the tools that the book offers, that you people offer, I don't know that I'd still be here. You know, because I would think that after all these years, you know, if I stop going to meetings, I've got this thing. And that becomes a willpower issue. I can do it myself. Thank you very much. Have a nice life. And I did that once before, and I got drunk over it early in my sobriety. And I'm grateful that I don't have to do those things today. I try to stay plugged into the meetings. I try to stay plugged into the literature and the big book, and also helping newcomers. That's where I get the most benefit out of it. You know, the new people I'm working with, they thank me profusely for helping them. I was like, no, no, you're helping me more than I'm helping you. And they don't understand that. I was like, you will. One day you will. Stay sober long enough and you will. And that's a spiritual theory or spiritual life that it's talking about here in this paragraph. I have to do these things. I can't just read about it and give it lip service. I've got to do these things. Thanks.
All right, also on page 83, there may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone.
I think there are absolutely wrongs that can never be fully made right, you know, and that was something emphasized a lot by my sponsor at the time, was that I have to show restraint in my amends because I feel guilty and I feel ashamed, so I want to tell you so that I can get it off my chest. And that is not the purpose of making amends, and I have absolutely no right to do that to the people around me. And there were a couple amends that I didn't get to make that I wanted to, you know, like my grandfather had passed in 2013. I was still very much drinking at the time. And anytime I went to visit him and my grandma, you know, I would root through everyone's medicine cabinet. I would do whatever I needed to do to get a buzz. And apparently nobody ever noticed. And I didn't know if anybody had ever noticed. And I didn't know if anybody knew what I was up to the whole time I was there. All I knew is it never came up. So when it came time to make amends, and that was something I was holding on to, I was told, you make a general amends for not being present, you know, for not, you know, adequately valuing your time with them. And then how about you take it from there and see what happens? And it's actually very funny because both my grandparents were in AA, and the moment I started, so we went to a couple meetings, me and my grandma, actually, the time that I was there, and I waited till the last minute of this trip to start to make this amends. Like, I'm not joking, like, in the car on the way to the airport, I start this conversation. and as soon as I said, you know, I think I need to make amends to you, she laughed at me. She laughed. She was like, amends, sweetie, no, you don't need to. And I was like, laugh at me. Making amends? You kidding me? Like, and I was so up in arms. But it's like, in that moment, you know, she knows I'm an alcoholic. She knows that I'm a drug addict. She knows that I steamroll over people to get what I want. She knows what we go through. She's an alcoholic too. She's not asking me any questions. She's not asking me for a confession. She doesn't want to know. So I don't need to tell her, and I have no right to tell her. And on a more egregious note, you know, with my parents, there's a big amends that I can never make, and I'm well aware. You know, when I first started going to AA, you know, they would take me, like they would drive me, drop me off, whatever, because they didn't trust me with a car, which was very smart because I would have driven drunk. And you know, so eventually when they thought I was sober, which I wasn't, I was just going to meetings and pretending to be sober so that I could continue to drink when they weren't paying attention. And, you know, eventually they get me a car and I'm like, sweet, awesome, let's do this. So they think I'm sober this whole time. And it's been a couple months now and I was far from sober. And, you know, I didn't drink this night, but in my desperate attempts to get out of my head, I took a whole lot of something I didn't need and overshot the mark by quite a bit. And, you know, my parents had to watch me, like, hard restrained to an emergency room bed, like, swinging on nurses. My heart rate's 50, or my blood pressure's 50 over 20. They have a crash cart in the room. I didn't wake up for, like, 2 days. And that was my doing. Like, I did that. But, you know, I panicked. They had the psych guy come in the room when I finally woke up. And, like, I talked to him and told him, like, I've been going to AA. I'm trying to be sober. I didn't do anything wrong. Blah, 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 blah. And this dude looked like he was, like, fresh out of college. So he totally bought everything I said. And, you know, when I told him the other medications I was on, you know, they noted that, you know. And they were like, well, this was probably a bad medication reaction. And my mom bought it because she wanted to believe that, you know. I'm fairly positive she, deep down within her heart, she knows that that was not a bad medication reaction. But point being, every time I'm even like slightly sniffly on the phone with her, she'll be like, please be careful. If you take anything, I don't want that to happen again. And it's like somebody's just twisting a knife in my stomach. And I'm like, God, I just want to tell you the truth. But I have no right. I have no right with everything they've seen me do, everything they've seen me go through, different hospitalizations, different rounds of treatment, you know, different overdoses, intentional and unintentional. They've seen me go through so much. If there's this one thing that they have a little peace of mind about, I have no right to take that away from them. I don't get to say, I feel bad about it, so I want you to know that this is what I did. When really in their minds, it's like, wow, what a freak accident. Like, what? Why do I get to take that from them just so it'll make me feel better? That goes against everything I've learned in the program up until the ninth step. And that was really hard for me. And it's still hard sometimes to look at things that I've done that I don't get to tell people. Because all of a sudden, when I start getting into who I really am in the program, I want everyone to know. I want to tell everyone, I'm like, here's what I learned about me today. And it's like, no, that's not how any of this works. I'm just supposed to be better, you know? And that's part of the way that I can make amends for these things that I can't talk about is be better. It's just be better. Know I did that, and know I'm not going to do it again, and know that I can and will behave better in the future. And, you know, it's funny when you're learning honesty for somebody to tell you, like, no, don't tell them that. It's like, you just told me to be honest. But you know, that's kind of a cop-out because I have no right, and it tells me that in the book. It says I have no right to save myself from the alcoholic pit at someone else's expense. And, you know, that was definitely a tough lesson for me to learn. But, you know, the people in my life don't deserve to be hurt anymore by me. I've hurt people around me enough. And I will continue to hurt people around me, and I will continue to make it right. But there's no need for me to dredge up things from the past just to make myself feel better. That's all I got on that.
Thanks.
You know, the ninth step says, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, I used to think it always said, whenever possible. When talks about time, and it's never a good time to make an amends, in my mind. And I was always the one that wanted to do the indirect amends. You know, I wanted to call someone, or I wanted to, you know, today's day and age, email them or text them. And that's not what it's about. You know, for me making amends, I've got a right or wrong. And, you know, my sponsor said to me a long time ago, Bill Williams, I was talking about, he said, you know, you make the amends because it's the right thing to do. You don't make the amends to feel good. You know, usually that's a byproduct of making the amends, but it's not the only reason, it's not the sole reason I do it. He used to say that, you know, when you make the amends, they get to pick. You know, when you tell them, what can I do to make things right? They get to pick. And, you know, if you owe money, it's like, I hate parting with money. And he says that, you know, you can't keep the money. And you've got to do what they suggest or what they want in order to make the amends right. And the section here where it talks about some wrongs can never be fully right. And I had a couple of those where people died, you know, and I owed them money. And, you know, what I did in the situation talking to my sponsor was I make anonymous donations, you know, every now and again. And it'll never fully make the situation right, but it's a step towards it. It's like a living amends, if you will. Even today, you know, when sometimes my wife and I get in disagreements, and she never seems to see my point of view, and I want her to see it, you know. And it's like, you know, she grounds me, you know. She points out things to me, not to, you know, be mean or anything, but things I don't necessarily always see. I don't see myself the way other people do, and she points out things to me, and it's like, I was the reason that whatever argument started, and I have to take a look at myself. And you know, the arguments don't last that long because I'm quick to, you know, see what my part is in it, and I'm quicker to make an amends and let her know that, you know, what I said or what I did was wrong. What can I do to make things right? And God, I hate doing that. You know, even nowadays, all these years later, it's a part of my humanness. And I'm not perfect, you know, and my ego is way out of bounds with God and society, and I don't want to admit I was wrong. And yet I know it's the right thing to do. I have to humble myself, you know, say what it is that I did, and go do it. And I don't feel any less of a person. You know, we talked about here that as God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Boy, this print keeps getting smaller and smaller as the years go on. And I have to do it. You know, I have to swallow my pride and do it. And in doing these things that we suggest, I benefit from it. I grow from it because I'm not the same person I was. And if I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, hopefully that behavior won't be repeated. But it's been a learning process. You know, it's one thing I've learned a long time ago that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, getting sober and everything, it's not a race. It's a journey that we have to do one day at a time. And I have to live this spiritual life.
Thanks. All right, I'm going to finish on page 83. This is the part you were talking about. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? Yep. We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
I'll be super honest on this one, right? I've always hated the way that people say we think not about the promises, because that is ridiculous. Those are 100% extravagant promises. And it's like, especially the fact that a lot of times we just call them the promises, when these are the ninth step promises. There are a lot of promises in the big book. It tells me all the time what's going to happen when I do something. It's just, in this particular case, we like them a lot, so we talk about them in a meeting, but we don't emphasize that they're the ninth step promises. So I was pissed when I was like halfway through my fifth step and I was like, I am not amazed. And, you know, I didn't know. I was just really confused on why I didn't see the promises coming true in my life. And I hadn't gone through my ninth step yet. So it would have been very, very good to know that, you know, there were the ninth step promises. But anyway, let me leave that alone. You know, I think they are absolutely extravagant. I didn't think I could have any of that when I got here. So I never said we think not, just out of defiance, because everybody would talk about, you know, how different their life was now that they're in AA, and, you know, they've done the steps, and, you know, they can look people in the eye, and I couldn't understand that. I saw where I was at, and I saw where you were at, and I didn't know how to get there. And I was just trudging my way through the steps, hoping that I would end up at the same spot you guys were. You know, when you talked about the fact that, you know, you can feel useful to other people. That's huge for me today, to feel useful. You know, to put other people before myself. You know, to make sure that I'm actually bringing something to the table in my relationships. You know, to make sure, like, the new freedom and the new happiness, oh my God. Some people that I'm still friends with from high school, like lifelong friends, still don't understand alcoholism. And they don't understand not drinking. And they're like, that must suck. And I'm like, dude, you have no idea. Like, it really doesn't suck. It sucks when I drink. And they should know, they were there. But, you know, and the fact that my experience can benefit others, that's my whole point in still being in AA, you know, because I'm not done, obviously, but I can go a while without a meeting and not drink because I have a strong relationship with a lot of people in the program. You know, I have a sponsor, I work steps, you know, but I'm not being useful to a newcomer sitting at my house on the couch thinking about AA. You know, like, I have to show up, you know, and I get to use my experience to benefit someone else. That's amazing. That means I didn't go through it for nothing. And that feels good to me. Because, I mean, maybe I did go through it for nothing. That sucks. But maybe I didn't, you know. Maybe I really can help somebody, and that's incredible. And, you know, I've had sponsees, I'll put that in air quotes, sponsees, because they never call me. You know, I tell people the demand for a 22-year-old sponsor is not very high in AA. So I have to get creative in how to be useful to people, you know? I try to offer rides. I tell people, I'll meet you at this meeting. I can point you in the right direction. I know someone who has experience like that. I don't have it personally, but I know somebody who does, and I'll point you their way. You know, it's just showing up. It's opening my mouth. It's asking God to use me to be useful. You know, and that's a huge thing. God doing for me what I can't do for myself, that's evident in every aspect of my life. And I could go on about that, about all these different things that have happened in my life that were absolutely not me. But, you know, the biggest thing is that I'm sober. Because left to my own devices, I get drunk every time. 10 times out of 10, I get drunk when I do it myself. And, you know, the big book tells me until I have a higher power, I'm without defense against the first drink. And I can't go back to being like that. You know, so I have to maintain a relationship with my higher power. And these promises stay true in my life when I stay on top of my stuff. You know, when I don't let self-will run riot, when I ask God to help me not let self-will run riot, you know, these things stay true. And it's pretty amazing, honestly. If you would have told me in early sobriety that those things were actually going to happen, I probably would have punched you. And, you know, it's incredible to see the difference just in other people, too. People that you saw get sober and you see them, you know, further down the line. It's incredible. It's amazing what this program does. And it's really hard to deny that this stuff works when you can see it and when you've experienced it yourself. So, I mean, the fact that I'm still here should be pretty convincing, because if it didn't work and it wasn't cool, like, I wouldn't be here, for sure. That's all I got tonight.
Thanks.
You know, early on, my sponsor pointed out to me that these promises came true when I drank. Reread them. Think about that. You know, fear of people and an economic insecurity would leave us. You know, and when I was in that drunken stupor, these promises was all I would think about. I didn't know this at the time, but looking back, hindsight being what it is, and when I applied what he said, it's true. When I retired from the Navy, I got a job as a contractor working up in the D.C. area for one of the three-letter agencies, and there was a meeting up there I would go to. It was on a Friday morning, and they would start the meeting with 5 minutes of meditation, and then they would talk about the promises. And the guest speaker for that day would pick one of the promises that meant the most to them, and they would talk about it, and then we'd go around the room and share. Probably my most favorite one is that we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. You know, the very first meeting I ever went to was a speaker's meeting. And the lady said that my name is whatever and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I hung on to that word grateful. Did she just say grateful? You know, I didn't understand what she meant by it. How could she say that she was grateful? You know, everything that alcohol did to me and all the scrapes of the law and all the trouble I'd gotten into, how could she say grateful? You know, and looking back, you know, I know exactly what she meant by that. You know, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic myself. And I hated my past for the longest time. I hated all the stuff that I did that got me into trouble, that got me to where I am today. I hated everything. And when you put everything in perspective, my past is my greatest asset because I can win, you know, the confidence of a newcomer. You know, I can share with them what it was like for me and what it felt like when I was drinking and, you know, the next morning, the Horatius hangover and everything. And I can relate to them and they can understand me. We speak the same language. And today I don't regret my past. I look at it as my greatest asset and I can win the confidence of a newcomer. The last sentence or the last part of it where it talks about they will always materialize if we work for them. You know, early on when I'd be at a meeting and, you know, I'd hear these promises read and I'm off in la-la land thinking about how great life's going to be because I stopped drinking, you know, my bank account's going to be full and I'm going to have this woman and this job and whatever. And I would always forget that last sentence. You know, they'll always materialize if we work for them. You know, I was the type of individual that wanted 10 years of sobriety in 10 days, and I didn't want to work for it. You know, I want to sit down to the piano and just start playing a beautiful piece of music. Never had lessons, but I want to sit down and do this. That's the alcoholic thinking, the mindset. And I know today that, you know, I get out of Alcoholics Anonymous exactly what I put into it. You know, and how it works, it talks about half measures availed us nothing. You know, I thought I could at least get half, and it doesn't work that way. And the one thing I've learned over the years is that any time I've coasted in Alcoholics Anonymous, I always coast downhill. It's a physical impossibility to coast uphill. And, you know, here I'm thinking that life is great, and, you know, I don't necessarily need a meeting tonight because I went to one last week, and, you know, I don't need to call my sponsor. He's a busy man, and I don't want to, you know, burden him with my issues. And it's like, you know, the longer I keep believing or I rationalize with whatever it is going on in my head, think about that word, rational lies. It's rational lies I'm telling myself, you know, that these things don't apply to me. You know, the laws of nature, the laws of society, the laws of gravity. You know, I can fly down my street at home where it's 25 miles an hour because the laws of society don't apply to me. Yeah, okay. See how far that gets me. I've got to work for these things. You know, that I just can't wish them upon me or wish them upon you. I've got to work for these. If I want to better myself, if I want to, you know, have my family members have a better life because I'm a better person, I've got to do these things. You know, just because it's been, you know, X number of years since I've had a drink doesn't mean that I can't revert back to the old stinking thinking. You know, I like to say that the monster's in the cage, but the door is unlocked. So that's enough out of me. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to pass the seven tradition baskets here. In the seven tradition states, every individual group ought to be fully self-supporting, counting outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seven tradition is essential at every level of any service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their groups, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might have hurt us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contributions is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support any service, as many services as it used to. Are there any AA-related announcements? All right. Newcomer. Anyone here in the first 30 days of sobriety?
There was an announcement.
Yeah, go ahead.
Melissa. Michael.
10th.
Jason Adekogolok.
Hey, Jason.
Also, the Wakefield Campfire Conference is the last weekend in September. We are looking for people that, anyone that might want to donate some items for the raffle that will be held that weekend. And if you guys have any questions, comments, concerns, feel free to ask me after the meeting.
Thanks.
Thank you. Over here.
I'm an alcoholic, man.
Hey, David.
Grateful to be here, grateful to be sober tonight. This group doesn't announce its events until we're inside of 30 days before the event. So I'm not announcing the September 2nd event, but I am announcing that there are watermelon-colored flyers on the table that are suggestive of summer, that have all the information about this event in this room on September 2nd with Don Major. It's all right there on the flyers. So if you take those flyers with you back to your groups, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
My name is Rob. I'm half out.
Hey, Rob.
September the 15th, 2 days having their annual picnic. It'll be from 10 to 4 at City View Park. There'll be a 50-50 raffle. A lot of fun. It's coming to us.
Thank you.
Were there any newcomers that I started to ask you about? You want to introduce yourselves?
Jay.
Hey, BJ.
Welcome.
Jason, Alec, alcoholic.
Jason, welcome. Glad you're here.
My name's
Nikki,
I'm alcoholic.
Hey,
Nikki. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Hi, I'm Jake, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
Jake. Welcome. Glad you're here.
I'm Evan, alcoholic.
Hey, Evan.
Evan, welcome. Glad you're here.
Glad you're here. All right, there's literature available on the table over there. You can see any home group member after the meeting. Any home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship and AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me. Smokers, please use the butt can provided and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. And I would like to ask, let's thank the panel again here, Jim and Jen. After we've seen up, all are invited to encourage to continue the conversation on steps discussed tonight, the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol, down Colonial, right before the train tracks. Someone read the last two paragraphs. Kendra?
I'm Kendra, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kendra.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you can't transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the records of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as we trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you
until then.
Amen. Amen. Close
this
Lord's
Prayer.
Brought us here tonight.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,